we inform.
Religious freedom is about people of faith being able to live out their faith, live out their convictions, no matter where they are.
We equip.
Sacred honor is the courage to speak truth, to live out your free speech.
We also rejoice in our sufferings because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance, character, and character, hope.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome to At the Core with Walker Wildman and Rick Green. I'm Rick Green, America's Constitution Coach. Thanks for joining me on this Thursday. Looking forward to talking to you. Get ready to send in those phone calls. We got a lot of headlines to get to first, and then we'll open up the phone lines. But, man, we got JFK files being released. We got President Trump maybe this afternoon signing an executive order to finally shut down the Department of Education. I've been screaming for this for decades, and it's actually happening. I'm pinching myself again today, folks. I'm telling you, the winning just keeps on coming. It's just amazing, amazing. And then, of course, the showdown between President Trump and these out-of-control district judges, and, of course, with John Roberts now, who comes to the defense of these rogue judges, saying that impeachment should not happen. So we definitely are going to get into that one. We actually teach on that in our Constitution classes, and dare I say, Chief Justice John Roberts is just flat out wrong on this one. And so we'll talk about that today as well, and then any other headlines that that y'all want to bring up and call in to discuss. Be sure and send those calls our way. 888-589-8840 is the phone number. Let's start with the Justice John Roberts versus Donald Trump on whether or not impeachment is a proper mechanism for reining in out-of-control judges. That's really the question of the day. Now Roberts doesn't name Trump, and Trump even says that, you know, that Roberts didn't name me. But there are other people out there that have made it very clear impeachment should be used with these rogue judges. Now, what do I mean by rogue judges? Let's back up even further. It's not just the decision that Trump made to get a bunch of rapists and murderers and get rid of them, get them out of the country, send them back to these countries where they came from. It's also, even the president being able to not send billions of dollars in fraud and waste around the world, supporting things that the American people do not support. So it's a lot of different executive actions that are going to be challenged in the courts. And the fundamental underlying question is, can a judiciary department, lowest level district judge, meaning they're over one little area of the country, do they have the power to stop the president of the United States, the executive branch, from doing what the executive branch is supposed to do? That's the fundamental question here. Now, of course, they're going to argue, well, actually what they're doing is they're stopping the president from doing something that Congress wants them to do, or they're stopping the president from doing something that maybe they're even arguing is not within the purview of the president. Okay, I'm okay with having judicial challenges to a president overstepping his authority. All for that. But in these situations, we're talking about authority that is well established for the president. Congress made it clear this is in the president's purview. The Constitution makes it clear. The courts have even upheld it as being in the president's purview. And then all of a sudden you're going to have one district judge suddenly rewrite all of that and claim that it's not in the president's purview, that it's outside the president's authority, and we're going to empower that unelected, unaccountable, single district federal judge to stop executive action. That's what we're talking about here, okay? We're not talking about even a showdown between the Supreme Court and the president. The president's made it clear that he will obey judicial decisions, that he's going to push, and if the Supreme Court pushes back and says, no, you can't do that, or no, you have to do this, he said he's going to obey that. I'm not even sure that I would. If there's a constitutional disagreement between the branches, which is to be expected, folks. Let's not just, live in this la-la land where we think everybody's unanimous on anything. There's never been a time in American history where all Americans have been unanimous. Never a time in American history where all the states, all of Congress, all of the judiciary, and then the executive, that everybody was on the same page and sang kumbaya and held hands and stood around the trees holding hands in their tie-dye shirts singing kumbaya. That has never happened. That's a pipe dream. We're humans. The nature of man, all of those things are going to, and we're just going to be different. We're going to have differing opinions. Hence the checks and balances of our particular form of a constitutional republic. I love that. I think that's great. I think we should have give and take. I think we should have differing opinions, and we got to have a way to resolve those differing opinions. Fortunately for us, the Constitution tells us how to do that. Fortunately for us, we don't live in a democracy where it's just a free-for-all, everybody gets their say, and just the law of the tiger and the shark, whoever's the most powerful ends up winning. Founding fathers hated that idea. They called it mobocracy, one of the greatest of evils. It's why when they said we were a threat to democracy, I said amen, because we're not a democracy. So since we're not a democracy, then what are we? We're not even just a simple republic. So we don't just send a bunch of representatives to Washington, D.C. and say, hey, do the best you can with what you got. You guys duke it out and figure out what the best answer is. No, we're a constitutional republic, which means we do elect people. We do choose leaders to go make those decisions for us within the jurisdiction that we've given them. So we say, hey, go do the best you can with what you got within these lines, which is what the Constitution does, is draw the lines. And our Constitution in the United States draws the lines around 17 things that we let the federal government do and that we empower them to do. Now, they're way outside the lines. They have colored way beyond the lines, no question. That's another discussion for another day, the fact that they're way outside the entire federal government's way outside its boundaries. But right now, the debate is over whether or not the president has within his jurisdiction the ability to remove people from our nation that are a danger to our nation. Does the president have the ability to make the decision about illegal aliens that are rapists and murderers and sowing all kinds of seeds of discontent and gang leaders and all of this? Does he have the ability to round up these gang leaders, these rapists and murderers and others? Does he have the authority to remove them from our country? Now, there's lots of things we could point to for the authority of the president to do that, being commander-in-chief, being over the executive department that runs the Border Patrol and the FBI and the Department of Justice and all of these other agencies, some of which I actually think aren't constitutional. But, for sake of this argument, without question, immigration, border control, those kind of things, those are proper federal functions. And so then how do you know if it's the president's job or it's some district judge? Did we somewhere do a constitutional amendment that says, okay, any district judge, a thousand of them or so, any federal district judge, you get to make law for America, for the whole country. Even though you're just a district judge in that one little area of the country, we're going to let you be the chief executive. Anybody remember that constitutional? I don't remember that constitutional amendment. I don't think that happened. So actually, they have no authority to tell the president that he cannot remove rapists and murderers and thugs that are here illegally. And they're gang members and mostly let out of prisons in other nations so that they could come here and wreak havoc. The district judge has, not only does he not have the ability to tell the president no, that district judge does not even have the authority to review the case. In other words, the proper function of the district judge in this case, when it was brought to him, the proper thing to say would have been, I'm sorry, that's not within my review. I don't have the authority to review this. It's not, there's a concept called positive exception. And positive exception comes out of Article 3 in the Constitution, which empowers the Congress to positively accept, meaning they get to say, courts, you get to hear all of these things except A, B, and C. And one of the A, B, and C things that the Congress has accepted from judicial review is the Alien Removal Act. So it's there were these, I think it was four different, maybe more than that, Alien Sedition Acts in the late 1700s. It was during the quasi-war with France, and Jefferson hated some of these because some of the Sedition Acts were actually preventing you from even criticizing the president. So some of this stuff definitely went too far. And so Jefferson reversed some of that, did enforce some of that, pardoned some people that had been put in prison over that. So there's a more sordid affair here on some of those things. But the Alien Act was specifically given to the president. The Congress passed this and told the president, you have the power to get rid of these people that are a danger to our country. Now, Congress has not removed that. Congress has not overruled that. The Supreme Court, in fact, has not ever said that was unconstitutional or that that act could not be used by the president to get rid of these thugs. In fact, it's been upheld as being something that the court doesn't get review over. It's very similar to, there was this McCardle case, I can't remember the exact years, right after the Civil War, might have even been during the Civil War, where the court had this great line where they basically said, I don't have it in front of me, so I can't give you word for word, but they basically said, when it comes to positive exception, when it comes to these things that the court does not have authority to even consider or review, that it is no less fitting. I remember that was one of the phrases. It's no less fitting for the judiciary to refuse to even hear it than it is for the judiciary to do its duty when it is something they should hear. Does that make sense? In other words, they were saying it's just as honorable and fitting and statesmanlike for a judge to say, sorry, this is not within my authority, as it is fitting and honorable and statesmanlike for a judge to say, okay, this is within my authority, and here's the right or wrong thing to do. In other words, know when it's not your job. Know when you're supposed to say, that's the president's authority, or that's the Congress's authority, or that's the state's authority, or that's the individual's authority, or that's the church's authority. Whoever has jurisdiction in that area, it ain't me. So I'm not going to be able to hear this case. That's what the district judge should have done in this particular case that everybody's talking about from, I guess it was 5 or 6 days ago when the president did this. So anyway, it's a very interesting situation. I hope that it's going to become a great constitutional lesson. I hope that it's a reminder of the fact that there are jurisdictions, that there are lines. The courts don't get to do everything, and they certainly don't have the final say on everything. I want to see if I can find Justice Roberts' line, because you know, this really cuts to a deeper issue. It cuts to this godlike, king-like mentality that the court has. They think that they are the end-all be-all. They think that they are the high priests of the law. You know, this was so bad when I was in law school 30 years ago that they didn't even teach us about impeachment. I mean, they didn't even talk about it, right? Because you're coming through the legal field and you're going to be a lawyer, you might be a judge someday, and we lawyers want to be the high priest of the law, and we want the judges to be the high priest of the law, and we want to be the all-powerful branch that doesn't have accountability to anyone. In their mind, independence means never accountable. That's not what the founders meant, but that's what these people think. So here's what Robert said about this. He said, for more than two centuries, it has been established that impeachment is not an appropriate response to disagreement concerning a judicial decision. The normal appellate review process exists for that purpose. Wait, what? Let me read that again. Listen carefully to what he's saying. It has been established. So first thing the bell that should be ringing in your head right now is established by whom? Established how? Like, where is that constitutional amendment that says no impeachment of judges when you disagree with their decision? I don't see that anywhere in the Constitution. I don't think it's been established constitutionally. Now, Justice Roberts, it may be established in his head. You know, he used the same terminology in the Obamacare case. He said a very similar thing. He said it's been, I'm trying to remember exactly how he said it, basically that it's been well established that the Commerce Clause has broad authority, that the federal government has broad authority under the Commerce Clause, that's been well established. Okay, well established by whom? Well established how? Like, where is that establishment? Where is that clear delineation that the Commerce Clause in the Constitution gives the federal government all these new powers that are not in the Commerce Clause? In the same way, Justice Roberts, where is it well established that impeachment is no longer an appropriate response when a judge is outside of their authority? So if a judge is violating the Constitution with their decision, who gets to tell them no? And what is Justice Roberts' answer? The appellate review process. What's he saying? He's saying, oh, don't touch us over here in the high priest world. We judges are not accountable to anyone but ourselves. I'm sorry, folks. I can't get on board with this, so I'm going to disagree vehemently with Justice Roberts. He is wrong on this. We'll talk more about it when we come back. This is so important for us to recognize proper jurisdiction, proper appellate process, and yes, the proper check and balance from other branches and from the state. Stay with us. You're listening to At the Core with Walker Wildman and Rick Green.
Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. My name is Abraham Hamilton III, and this is the Hamilton Minute. The Oversight Project found an excessive use of auto pen signatures by Mr. Biden when he was in the White House. The investigation gathered every document we could find with Biden's signature over the course of his presidency. All used the same auto pen signature except for the announcement that the former president was dropping out of the race last year. President Trump responded, "The pardons that Sleepy Joe Biden gave to the Unselect Committee of Political Thugs and many others are hereby declared void, vacant, and of no further force or effect because of the fact that they were done by auto pen." Things are getting interesting. Could this lead to potential criminal prosecution of some of the pardoned?
Listen each weekday from 5 to 6 p.m. Central for the Hamilton Corner with Abraham Hamilton III, public policy analyst for the American Family Association.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio with your host, Rick Green.
Welcome back to At the Core with Walker Wildman and Rick Green. I'm Rick Green, America's Constitution Coach. We are talking about the Constitution today in light of the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court trying to act like they're, you know, the court has everything handled. We will hold our judges accountable and no one else has any say. That's essentially what he's saying whenever he says that impeachment is not appropriate. And I want to remind you, if you weren't listening a few minutes ago, or even if you were, I just want to say it again. Listen to his words. It's been established that impeachment is not an appropriate response to disagreement concerning a judicial decision. The normal appellate review process exists for that purpose. Okay, established by whom? What Justice Roberts is saying is the same thing he said in the Obama case, that we, the high priest of the law, the Supreme Court, the final say, your overlords, in other words, unelected, unaccountable, we will tell you what the proper way to deal with a decision that we disagree with is, or we will tell you what the power of the federal government is, that we have established that the Commerce Clause gives broad authority to the federal government. I know that's a separate issue from this judicial, from this impeachment thing of judges, but just to point out the lunacy of this and how unconstitutional this is and how it flies in the face of being a constitutional republic. This whole Commerce Clause thing. Now, if you go to the Constitution and you read the Commerce Clause, it's one of the things that is one of the powers of the federal government. Okay, it's one of the things listed in Article 1, Section 8, but it's very, very limited. In fact, let me see if I can find it here and read it to you. It's basically three things. So it gives the federal government the ability to make commerce regular, is what they meant when they said regulate commerce. We hear regulate commerce, and we think, because it's how they do it in the last 100 years, we think regulate, oh, that means they get to micromanage every transaction. They get to make all the rules for how you're going to buy something or what you can buy or what the features that have to be on this product. And that's the kind of regulation they do today. That is not what it means when it says to regulate commerce. It means to make regular, meaning protect the commerce system and make sure that everybody's being treated the same. In other words, free enterprise. It had everything to do with states blocking commerce from coming into their state. In other words, blocking merchants from the neighboring state from being able to come in and compete with their merchants. That's what this was all about. Stopping the prevention of free enterprise. That's what the Commerce Clause was. Make sure that you have a free flow of commerce between the states, across state lines, with the Indian tribes, and with other nations. But make it clear that the federal government, that is a proper function of the federal government to keep those lines open. And yeah, it makes sense that the federal government would be the one to negotiate with other countries to make sure that free flow of commerce is happening, or to negotiate with the Indian tribes that had sovereign territory and make sure there's free flow of commerce there, or to make sure that one state was not blocking commerce from another state. So let's see if I can find it here, and I'll read the actual clause. I think it's clause four from three. Okay, so to regulate trade. Oh, sorry, I'm reading the Constitution Made Easy, which is my buddy Mike Collar's version that we have in all our workbooks. The original language in the Constitution says to regulate commerce with foreign nations, comma, and among the several states, comma, and with the Indian tribes. That's it. And then the Supreme Court started opening up that clause, that paragraph right there, and saying, literally said, just a few years before, they said, oh, you can't do a minimum wage. That doesn't fit within the Commerce Clause. You can't do regulating a meatpacking plants. You can't do, I mean, they slapped down the Congress from doing all this new, you know, all of FDR stuff. And then when FDR threatened the court, I'm going to pack the court, they got wimpy and they said, oh, well, now all of a sudden, if we stand a little bit different, if we shine the light a little bit different, if we hold our paper just right, oh, now I see in the Commerce Clause, yeah, you can do a minimum wage. Somehow, that's regulating commerce among the several states. It wasn't last year, but it is this year. Oh, yeah, you can regulate meatpacking plants. Somehow, that's right here in the Commerce Clause. And so the court started expanding the Commerce Clause and did it for 90 years. Did not say no to the Congress and the president expanding federal power, not one time for about 90 years. I mean, they even started saying in the Wickard v. Filburn case, if you want to go regulate some guy that's growing wheat on his property who's not even selling, not only not selling across state lines, he's not even selling it next door or down at the farmer's market. We're going to let you do that because somehow his decision not to sell that wheat might affect the price of wheat going across state lines. I mean, they started connecting all these dots that never existed before. Now, no amendment to the Constitution. Nobody changed the language of the Commerce Clause. The Supreme Court changed the implementation of the Commerce Clause. So when John Roberts uses these words, well established, or it's been established for centuries, what he's really saying is we, the high priest of the law, have changed the Constitution without your permission. That's what he's saying. It's never been changed by we the people with a constitutional amendment. It's been changed by these out of control, unaccountable high priest of the law known as judges. Okay, now I'm not anti-judiciary. I want a judiciary. I want biblical justice. I want a judiciary that will uphold the Constitution, that will tell the other branches or the states or an individual when they do something that's unconstitutional. That's the proper function of the court, or to apply the law that the Congress made and the president made together to a particular fact circumstance. Totally legit judicial function. We want that. We want a healthy judiciary. But what we're talking about right now is an unhealthy judiciary. We're literally living out what Alexander Hamilton warned about in Federalist 78. He talked about the fact that if you ever allow, he actually said the court's the weakest branch. You don't have to worry about them. They're not going to take away your liberty. They have neither the purse or the sword. You know, president's got the sword. Congress has got the purse. There's no way you got to worry about your liberty from the court unless they get over into the executive or over into the legislative. And when you start blurring those lines and you let these unelected, unaccountable judges get involved in those areas, they start making law or enforcing law, you better be worried at that point because now you have everything to fear from the court. And that's what we're now dealing with, the court trying to make law. The court trying to execute the law. The court trying to tell the president what he's got to spend money on. The court trying to tell the president when he can actually do what Congress told him to do, get rid of the thugs and take them somewhere else, but don't let them stay here in our country. When you have a court that starts telling the president to do how to do those things, you should be concerned about your liberty. So what do you do about it? Well, Hamilton addressed that as well. He said impeachment is a bridle in the hands of the legislature. Let that sink in for a second. Get that word picture, okay? I want you to picture a horse that's a wild horse, or it's a horse that's getting wild. It's getting out of control. What's the bridle for? To rein in that horse, to rein them in, to be able to guide them in the right direction. Impeachment is a bridle in the hands of the legislature. Use that word picture right now that Alexander Hamilton gave us. That's the picture of Congress impeaching a president, impeaching a judge, impeaching anyone that has gotten out of control, that is exercising unconstitutional authority. So Justice Roberts, you are 100% wrong here. You're 180 degrees on the wrong side of this. Not only has it not been established that impeachment should not be used whenever a judge is outside their constitutional authority, it's actually been established in the Constitution and by the precedent that it's the proper function of the in this case it would be the House to impeach this judge and then the Senate to convict this judge. That's the proper constitutional way to deal with somebody that's being unconstitutional. So Roberts is wrong. President Trump is right. The other people that are calling for impeachment are right. And we should go – maybe it's a great time for a lesson, right? Maybe it's a great time to get people to go through our Constitution class. In fact, I encourage you, go to patriotacademy.com, sign up to be a Constitution coach or host, and host one of these classes, and we dive deep into this. In fact, on today's Wall Builders Radio program, David Barton and I will be talking about this, and Tim Barton talking about this on our Foundations of Freedom Foundation program. In fact, it was the only – normally we get through a lot of questions from the audience, and we got one question, and that was it. We spent the whole day talking about exactly this because it's so important to remind people of these jurisdictions. I've said for a long time, if you want the Constitution to be revived, if you want to restore a constitutional republic, if you want to pass freedom intact to the next generation, to your kids and grandkids, you have to restore jurisdictions. We have to get people to start thinking once again about the jurisdictional lines, both of government, so if government, which government, you got to know the jurisdictional lines, and of ourselves. What's our jurisdiction? You have certain jurisdiction as a parent or as an individual or as a church leader, as a business owner. We've got to start thinking about proper authority. And we teach that in the Constitutional Live class and the Biblical Citizenship class. Go take those. PatriotAcademy.com. That's where you want to go. This is essential to restoring the country. And I think it goes back to why President Trump's executive actions, why I've been so excited about them, because so many of them, that's what he's doing. He's restoring the jurisdictional lines. Some of these things he's basically saying, let's take Department of Education. If he ends up doing that, maybe he's doing it right now, I don't know, but he's supposed to be signing an executive order today to start that process of getting rid of the Department of Education and sending all of that back to the states. Well, folks, that's the proper constitutional jurisdictions anyway. There's nothing. I mean, I'm holding up, I know most of you are listening, some of you are watching online. There's nothing in the Constitution that says that the federal government should have anything to do with education. Now, wherever you're listening to us right now, whatever state you're in, your state constitution talks a lot about education because it's a state function. It's a state jurisdiction. Nothing in the Constitution about education. Why? Because it's not a federal function. There should be no Department of Education. There should be no, what was the department called before the Department of Education? It was like Department of Health and Education and something else. Anyway, there should be no federal involvement in education. What do those people know at the federal level about how your education system should work in your local community? Nothing. They've done nothing but make education worse. I think if I read this correct, there's $3 trillion now that's been spent through this Department of, what should we actually call them? Department of Indoctrination, maybe. Department of Uneducation. I mean, because education's only gotten worse after that $3 trillion got spent. It's only gone downhill. All the test scores are going down. The satisfaction of parents or employers or the students themselves, all gone down. It's only gotten worse with the involvement of the federal Department of Education. Why? Because they're just not good at it. It doesn't work when you send authority 1,000 miles away to a bunch of bureaucrats, not even showing up for work. Now they're working from home. But if you send that authority 1,000 miles away and you say, please tell us how to educate our kids, I mean, first of all, that makes no sense. And most people listening to that you understand that doesn't make sense to tell someone 1,000 miles away, please help me educate my child. Please show me what they need to learn. They don't know what's best for your kid. Your state government probably doesn't, I know they don't know better than you know, but maybe they know best for your particular state what a diploma should mean. So maybe they are the best outlet for defining a diploma. And where I live in the state of Texas, it should be the legislature saying, if we're going to spend money on education, here's what it should result in. They ought to know how to do reading, writing, arithmetic. They ought to understand civics. They ought to know what it means to be a good citizen. That makes sense. If we're going to spend money on education so that we have an informed citizenry, which is what most constitutions, that's the magic phrase, informed citizenry, then yeah, you set that standard for what a diploma means at the state level, not the federal level. It is different. It's different in Texas or California or whatever. And I wouldn't presume to tell Californians how they should educate the people of California, and they shouldn't tell me in Texas how we should be educating people in Texas. And certainly Washington, D.C., should not be telling us how to educate our children or what the best best way to do that is or what the diploma should actually mean. So anyway, we're not in a constitutional crisis. I don't agree with all the people that are saying that. We're actually in a constitutional execution. It's the actually the living out of the Constitution. This is the proper way in a constitutional republic to execute the law, to have debates about what's the proper authority for the president, proper authority for these different places. This is the right way to do it. Have discussions like we're having right now on radio. Let them debate it in Congress. Let the Chief Justice say what he thinks is the right way to do this. And the president, this is part of the reason why we call it the opinion of the court. If one of these cases gets all the way to the Supreme Court and the court says no to President Trump, which they actually did on the, now it wasn't the merits of the case, but on this USAID thing, this was the one I talked about a couple of weeks ago that Justice Alito said he was stunned that the court would uphold the temporary injunction that district judges made about, you know, President Trump not spending that $2 billion with USAID. Okay, well, let them have the opinion of the court. But the president could actually say at that point, he's not doing it, but he could say, nice opinion. Now let me see you enforce it. It's what Andrew Jackson did. He could say, okay, I appreciate your opinion. I'll review your opinion. I'll take it into consideration. But when it comes to faithfully executing the law, that phrase is not in Article 3 of the Constitution. That phrase is in Article 2. It's the president's job to faithfully execute the law, not the courts. And the courts should not be telling him how to do that. Now, Congress can tell him how to do that. If Congress wants to pass a law and make it veto-proof, override the president and say, we think you should be doing X, Y, and Z instead of, you know, A, B, and C, okay, go for it. So that's the I don't see that as unhealthy. I see that as the give and take and the checks and balances and the robust free society that we live in, and we should embrace that and be excited about the fact that it gives us the chance to talk about these things. It gives us the chance to debate them. It gives us the chance to sort of figure out some of these new areas that haven't been covered before. But this one, this whole alien removal, that one has been covered before, literally 200 years ago. Roberts was right about that, being that long ago for some of these things. But nothing in the Constitution, nothing that the Supreme Court has said, nothing that Congress has redone or a new law in any way removes President Trump's ability to do this, to get rid of these rapists and murderers, get rid of these thugs, and execute the laws that the Congress has passed. What a great time to be alive, to have a president that's willing to push that envelope, that's willing to go to bat for we, the people, willing to go to bat for the Constitution, willing to go to bat for just restoring some sanity and some safety to our country. I'm excited about it. I don't think it's the last challenge. I think you're going to see tons of lawfare throughout this presidency. And thankfully, this is a guy that's been there, done that, not afraid of that, and willing to fight it on every level. And then if he loses, being willing to say, okay, I lost on that one. I will concede to the Congress or the courts or wherever that might be. So great time to be alive, folks. We'll take a quick break. We'll be taking your calls when we come back. 888-589-8840. You are listening to At the Core with Walker Wildman and Rick Green.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio with your host, Rick Green.
Welcome back to At the Core with Walker Wildman and Rick Green. I'm Rick Green, America's Constitution Coach. Thanks for staying with me. 888-589-8840 is the phone number. 888-589-8840. First up today is Tom in Ohio. Tom, let's see here. Make sure I can hit the... Oh, sorry, guys. If y'all could connect Tom, I hit the wrong button and closed out
my
call screener. Tom, hey, man. Thanks for calling
in.
Bro, go ahead.
Hey, I have a two-part kind of a question comment, but I have been reading the Federalist Papers, and I'm looking at Federalist Paper number 12. Are you familiar with them?
Oh, you got to remind me, bro. I don't remember all 80 of them or 80, whatever it is. Yeah, go ahead.
85, yeah. It talks about the utility of the union in respect to revenue from the New York Packet. And there, and this is talking about taxes, but I'm going to read the sentence. It says, there are points of view in which its influence will appear more immediate and decisive. It is evident from the state of the country, from the habits of the people, from the experience we have on the point itself, that it is impracticable to raise any very considerable sums by direct taxation. that's telling me, you know, Hamilton and all of them saw that, you know, taxing everybody directly is it's absolutely painful. And then I know in this Constitution, the 16th Amendment, you know, ratified 1913, where Congress laid and collect taxes from incomes. And my question is, why? Why are we being taxed so dang much?
Well, there's two different underlying questions in what you're saying. One is, what's the best way to tax? And then, and two is, why is the tax so high right now? And the second question is easier to answer, because it's because of what we were talking about in the first two segments. Because the government is doing 17 million things outside its jurisdiction instead of only the 17 things within its jurisdiction, they're spending trillions of dollars they shouldn't be spending. Not to mention, they're putting burdens on us in addition to just paying taxes, just the regulatory and albatross around our necks. So that part's easy. I mean, if they would stop doing all these things they're not supposed to be doing, we would save trillions of dollars. We would have lower taxes. In terms of the best way to tax, I'm not, even though I just quoted from Hamilton when it comes to the judiciary, I'm not a Hamilton fan on monetary policy and the banks and all the stuff that he would later be an advocate for. He kind of became almost like the liberal of the founders, if there was one. Not that there really was one, but compared to the other ones, everything is relative, right? So compared to the other founding fathers, he became sort of the expansion of the federal government guy. Compared to most of the other founding fathers. So my personal conviction, just from, you know, looking at other systems and watching what human nature responds to well, my personal conviction is that income tax is punitive and discourages ingenuity and making more money and hard work. And so anytime you increase income taxes, you're going to decrease the productivity of those who are being taxed. And it's sort of like what Ronald Reagan said a long time ago, because of the progressive income tax and because it got to the point where, in his case, as a wealthy movie star, he was getting to the point where he was at like a 94% tax rate in and so he's like, if I only get 6% of the money and 94% is going to go to the government, I'm not going to make another movie. I'm tapped out, man. I'm only going to make so much, only going to make so many movies. And then that's where he got his Reaganomics idea, which was really just supply side economics and pre-Keynesian economics. He basically said, okay, but if I don't make the movie and the people that are other people that were going to make the movie are at the 94th percentile and they decide not to make the movie, who really misses out at that point? The people in the lower tax bracket. So what they kind of made fun of him and called it trickle down economics, right? What he was really saying was, if the wealthiest people and the business owners, the people that are the inventors, the people that are really the hardest working in the country, if you punish them to the point that they say, forget it, I'm just going to stop working, now you're actually hurting the people that needed the work the most, the people that are in the lowest tax bracket, because now that movie doesn't get made. So the grips and the light camera operators and the people that weren't making as much as he was making as the star of the movie, they're the ones that get hurt the most. And so I completely agree with that theory and with that philosophy. I think taxing income is always counterproductive. I think the only proper, I think moral taxation is sales tax. I think you should only collect tax for government when the transaction happens. When you decide, so you go make however much money you make. You don't get punished for that. If you save, if you invest that money in your house and in your property, or you go buy more land or whatever, the only time you get taxed is when you spend the money, so then you have an incentive to save, and it's a one-time thing when you spend it, and it's on the receipt. So you know how much government is costing you. You know how much government is punishing you for spending that money. And it's a constant reminder that you want to keep government in check and keep them from spending so much. I think part of the reason we've let government get out of control is because people get taxed on their income before they get their income. And they just think about take-home pay. And they don't even calculate it anymore how much the government's actually costing them. So when they look, you know, it's kind of funny. You hear people say, who's this FICA guy? Who's this FICA person that's taking all my check, right? And so it's because they have no idea what government's actually doing to them in the amount of money that it's taking from them. So to your basic point in your question, Tom, 100%, they're taxing us way too much. The right way to tax us would be tariffs and sales tax. Those, and a tariff is a sales tax. That's essentially a sales tax on anything coming into the country. Otherwise, when you're taxing income, when you're punishing people for making money, or you tax property, I think that's a horrible way to tax. When you tax property, you're punishing people for owning their own property or investing in their own property. If the tax man shows up at your house, this happened to me, I guess, 30 years ago. We added a little room onto our house. And you had a little bitty 1,200 square foot house. We're adding a room because we had more kids. And so this guy literally shows up at my property, and he's measuring this little room that we added to our house. And I walk outside. I'm like, who are you? And what are you doing on my property? And turns out he's from the government. You know, I'm from the government. I'm here to help, that kind of thing. He's literally measuring the room we added to our house in order to tax us more because we improved on our home. So now we're punished every year, and we pay the government more because we had to provide for more children in our home. Does that make any sense to anyone? That's punitive and wrong. Now, pay sales tax on the 2x4s when we went down to the hardware store to buy it? Okay, I can live with that. I have to calculate into my decision to spend that money that I'm going to have to pay so much in sales tax so I can only build so much more onto the house, or only buy so much of a car, or only spend so much on that vacation, or whatever it might be. Sales tax is the way to do it. It's upfront. You know how much you're going to have to spend. You can plan for it. I think even instead of having property taxes on your home, you ought to pay sales tax when you buy the home one time. You roll it into the mortgage, and when you get done paying for your house, friend, it's yours. You know what happens right now? You rent your property from the government your entire life, and then your kids rent it from the government, and then whoever gets it after them rents it from the government. You're serfs on feudal land. You don't own the land. The government does. And if you think I'm wrong about that, try not paying your taxes and see who gets possession of the land. It's wrong. It's immoral. We should completely get rid of property taxes, get rid of income taxes. It ought to all be based on sales tax, including tariffs on property that's coming in, or goods and services that are coming in from other countries. Okay, let's go back to the phones. And if you want to join us, 888-589-8840 is the phone number. 888-589-8840. Headed out to Oregon. Jane, you're up next. Go for it.
Hey, I got something going in my head, you know, with all the backlash we've been getting from the, should we call them the Democrat brown shirts? Yeah, really. Anyway, we worked hard, all of us. I probably worked harder on this election than I worked ever in my life for any kind of an election. And we got, you know, we got what we worked for. And then we sit back on our laurels and watch everybody fight. I think we ought to be texting, writing letters, making yes. phone calls. There's got to be some way to let old Roberts know. I don't appreciate that.
Yeah.
But he's defending illegal aliens. They want to use our tax money to defend them. Forget it.
Yeah. I couldn't agree with you more. And Jane, I will say this. I think a lot of people, way more than at any time in my lifetime, are not sitting back on their hands. In other words, the typical human reaction is, as soon as the election's over, because we work so hard, okay, we put them in place, now they're supposed to go do the job, and we can get back to our lives and back to our regular work. But thankfully, this time, for the first time in my lifetime, tons of people have heeded the call of what you're saying right now, because we've been saying the same thing. As we've been saying, hey, election day is not over. Election day is just the beginning. In fact, I would argue we won the coin toss. That's it. Now we have to get on the field and fight the battle and win the game. We have been given permission of the king to rebuild the walls. We're in the early part of chapter 2 of Nehemiah, the king being we the people, not some king like they had back then. We've been given permission by the people to go rebuild the walls. But now we got to go lay the bricks. Now we got to put the mortar in. Now we got to have the sword in one hand, the trowel in the other. We got to make sure that we're staying engaged. I agree with you 1,000%. Everybody listening right now, if you were fired up about the election, it did not stop on election day. If you were fired up to get President Trump in there and replace the Biden regime, then it didn't stop on January 20th. We have to hold them accountable, including President Trump. So if he goes out of line and he does an unconstitutional executive order, you're going to hear me rant about it here on the program. If he starts doing things that we disagree with, we should absolutely say so and give or refuse our consent, like the Declaration says. But even more so than that, because it's hard to hold the federal ones accountable. Like you're mentioning Chief Justice John Roberts. I mean, that's virtually impossible to hold him accountable because he doesn't listen to the people. He's not afraid of impeachment. The bridle in the hands of the legislature has not been used. So a guy like Roberts is convinced that they will never impeach him. So he just, you know, does the things that he does. But there's other things you can do to not sit on your hands. There's so much more you can do at the local level than at the federal level. And so I'm going to continue my mantra that right now is the time to press the gas. Right now is the time to take back ground in our local communities. And that includes restoring a God consciousness, getting the Ten Commandments up in your schools and your courthouses. We're in a concentrated effort on that with First Liberty right now. In Georgia, we've got a big movement going there to get it up. The law's already been passed, but we've got to get it done in every courthouse, in every county throughout Georgia. We've got 15 states right now running legislation to do the same thing. Utah passed it. Louisiana passed it. We're close in Texas. Tim Barton was just in Arkansas testifying on theirs. So let's get the Ten Commandments, get the God consciousness back in our schools and our courthouses. Let's get In God We Trust, the national motto, put on every government dais, you know, right there in front of the government officials in your county, in your community. Let's get the Declaration principles being taught in every school in America. Let's teach them to ourselves and our family. So if you want to make sure you're not sitting back on your hands and you're engaged, go read my book, Freedom's Frame. Read about the principles in the Declaration. We're 411 days from the 250th birthday of the nation. So we're going to celebrate the Declaration of Independence in a big way over the next year. One of the best ways for you to do that is to learn the Declaration. So get my book, Freedom's Frame. It's all about the Declaration of Independence. And then take a Constitution class and restore biblical citizenship for yourself and your community. So start hosting these classes in your home, in your church, and that will raise the civic literacy so people understand what is constitutional, what isn't, what's being a good biblical citizen. How do I live out my citizenship in a biblical way? How do I treat my neighbor the way I want to be treated? Restore not only biblical citizenship and the Declaration principles and a God consciousness, but restore federalism. So this whole thing I've been ranting about today, the idea that the federal government should only do these 17 things and that the courts should only do certain things, the president should do certain things, the Congress should do certain things, and then the states are responsible for certain things. Restoring federalism is possibly the most important thing that we'll do in the next few years for a long-term system of freedom. So not just 4 years of restoring liberty in our country, but four generations. Lots and lots of things that we can do to make this happen. All right, let's go to, let's see who's up next. We got Jesse in Texas. Jesse, you're up next. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on this recession and where we're headed. Are you guys going to know how to handle that? I'm a Democrat.
Who's you guys?
The Republicans.
Oh,
the richy rich, the people that have money, that make money on other people.
Oh, you mean the Democrats in that case, right?
No. We're the poor people. Remember, Democrats. You grew up a Democrat. You're poor.
You don't actually buy that line anymore, do you? I mean, have you looked at the studies of who the Democrat voters are and who the Democrat politicians are? The multi millionaire politicians that I mean, the folks like Pocahontas, senator that came in poor and then all of a sudden is worth millions and millions of dollars. I don't know if you've looked at that, but that's actually the Democrats are the ones with. And they're also the ones that I will give you Democrats credit, man. You put your money where your values are. You spend those millions of dollars influencing public opinion and buying politicians. So you're good at that. But the answer to your question, can we handle the inflation and the recession that the Biden administration created? And the answer to that is absolutely yes. The policies that President Trump is putting in place and that the Congress are putting in place, cutting spending, giving freedom back to the American people, putting more money in the pockets of the American people so they'll then go spend it in the marketplace. Every time that's been done, either by a Democrat like JFK, who did that in 1961, or by a Republican like President Reagan in 1981 and President Bush in 2003, I believe it was, it's worked. And so President Trump's going to do the same thing. And yes, we will get past that recession that Joe Biden created, and we will again have good times in this country because we again have tough leaders that know how to do this right. Thanks for listening today, folks. I'm Rick Green. You've been listening to At the Core with Walker Wildman and Rick Green. Little things can make a difference. A little note, little smile, the small stone that David hurled at Goliath, and precious little babies. When you sponsor an ultrasound at Preborn, your gift, no matter how small, makes a difference in a big way. Who will this little baby become? What giants will this baby slay? How about the mother who was spared from unspeakable sorrow because of you? You never know the difference you're going to make with a donation of just $28 to introduce a mother to her child through ultrasound. It doubles a baby's chance at life. All you have to do is take a few small minutes to make a life-saving donation. Preborn will take it from there as their network of clinics rescue 200 tiny babies every day and share God's love with mothers. Preborn has a 100% charity rating, so you can give with confidence. Get involved today by dialing #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.